Hey everybody, welcome back to the MMA Vivisection with me, Zane Simon, and my co-host, as always, Connor Rebush.
That's me.
That's me. Little harmony thing going.
Yeah.
Can't harmonize.
That's me. That's me. My favorite harmony, a double flat five. Beautiful, Zane. Microtonal harmony.
Yes. Oh. I mentioned that my favorite artist is Bjork falling down a flight of stairs.
I heard a Bjork song the other day, and I had the feeling of, I should listen to more Bjork.
Yeah, she's
interesting.
When her songs land,
mm-hmm.
they land perfectly. I'm like, oh my God, this is amazing. And when they don't land, I'm like, okay, you know what? Just please, never again.
This is the most annoying thing I've ever heard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All right. We're talking here about this UFC Apex card going down this Saturday, headlined by a flyweight bout between Matthews Nicolau and Alex Perez.
Is it going down this Saturday? Because to me, it feels like it's coming back up.
Yeah. We're chewing it twice.
Mm.
It was supposed to be Nicolau Cop. Which, you know, Cop is at least a he still has championship aspirations on the horizon.
Yeah.
So there was a fair bit of meaning in that fight.
That one was a worse looking style matchup than this.
Mm-hmm.
But a more meaningful fight.
Yeah. Nicolau and Perez are at this point really just treading water in the middle third of the flyweight rankings.
Yeah, I mean these are guys who fulfill a very needful role.
Sure.
In the roster, doesn't necessarily feel like a main event.
No, because like I said, it's clear at this point that neither of them are ever going to be contenders. You know.
I actually can't believe they didn't do Ryan Spann, Bogdan Guskov as the main event just because they're
especially
80 pounds heavier.
And because Guskov looks so much like Anthony Smith, they probably just put him there.
Oh, shit. You're telling me that's not Anthony Smith?
Oh, we booked him for the next pay-per-view main card, of course.
Huge. Actually, be really funny if Anthony Smith showed up for this because it's an Apex card. And then Guskov, by mistake, shows up for UFC 301, where Anthony Smith is booked.
That's right.
Nobody notices, not even the fighters themselves.
Yeah, Smith just assumed he was headlining at the Apex, so he showed up for this.
Yeah.
And then they actually had to, like, hustle Guskov out of the arena and, like, put him on ice for a week for UFC 301. Get him out. Get him to Brazil, stat.
Bogdan Guskov waking up, you know, covered in cold sweat in the middle of the night, telling his wife that he's dreaming as Anthony Smith.
That's right.
Who am I? Yeah, but instead we get the flyweights as the main event, which, as Phil said, I think this is probably what happened. That this is the outward outward. This is the tip of the iceberg that we see of a war between like matchmaking forces behind the scenes of the UFC.
Mm-hmm. This is the spite architecture.
Exactly. Yeah. One guy is like, the flyweights have fun fights. They're exciting. We got to put them in more main events. And then the more traditionalist guy is like, oh, you want flyweight main events? Okay, here you go. You get this, and then you get next week. You get two flyweight main events. He's like, is that good? Do you like that? Idiot.
Yeah.
Because I've been begging for some flyweight main events. And this is what I get. This is a good fight, to be clear. It's just.
It is.
It's a co-main event.
It's just meaningless. Like I said, you know, at the point that Nicolau got absolutely starched by Brandon Royval.
Uh-huh.
You kind of feel like, I mean, that was the point where it was either he's going to get to a title shot or it's not going to happen. Maybe he goes on another run. He's only 31. But that really did feel like a door being closed, you know, to me. And Alex Perez has had that door closed several times now. He, in fact, has not won a fight since 2020 against Jussie Formiga. You know? Like, it just doesn't, it just doesn't feel... It even though both guys are still ranked in the flyweight division.
That's what I was going to say. It says the logic behind this is exactly what it says on the poster that they definitely tried when creating.
Yeah.
Number 5 versus number 8. They don't seem to have any recognition of like what's happening in the division, who's got momentum, who's set up. They're just like, "Oh, these guys have numbers. That's a main event."
Yeah, it'd be like booking Neil Magny against Stephen Thompson for a main event. You're like, okay, I get it. They're both ranked. They've had some fun fights. But
we know what's up, and these guys
are not title contenders. Yeah, nobody's going anywhere off of this fight at all.
These are not title contenders.
Yeah. You want your main events to have... either have, you know, somebody that is a fan favorite that people just show up to watch all the time and will always will. Or you want it to be somebody who is on their way to somewhere, you know? They're on the cusp of bigger things. And it's not that.
No. No, it is not.
So, on that note, let's talk about it. What... Nicolau Perez as the matchup. It is a good well matched fight, you know. At the very least, we have a guy that always goes forward when he gets the opportunity against a guy who is happiest moving backward. And
who will respond to pressure with counters.
Yes, but who will respond to pressure with counters, which means that both guys get the kind of fight they want.
Yeah, Nicolau is a very one-note fighter, not in that he can't be exciting, but that he's extremely matchup dependent. He does the same, tries to do the same thing to everybody. And if you've seen some of Nicolau's pre-UFC fights, you know that when he's against a really aggressive opponent, he can be very, very exciting.
Yeah, he the more you give him that he can respond to, the happier he is with the fight.
I mean, shit, the fight with Brandon Royval didn't last long, but it certainly wasn't dull.
No, yeah.
You know, he is going to meet people who come at him because that's what he wants. He wants to. He is a very, very pure counter puncher. And Alex Perez is almost always a pressure fighter.
Yep. When he's not getting to pressure fight, that's usually just a sign that he is losing right out of the gate.
Yeah. So, yeah, I fully expect a pretty entertaining dynamic here. It's one of my favorite sort of categories of style matchup. The damper is really still not necessarily having a good feeling about where Alex Perez is at. It's not purely negative. Like,
yeah,
I thought he did quite well against Muhammad Bakayev.
Yeah. He was a great proof of concept of what we've been saying about Makhachev all along.
Yeah.
Which is that while he's a good athlete, or he's a good wrestler and grappler and a decent athlete, he's not the level of athlete he thinks he is. And the higher up the chain he goes, the more his game, which is designed for him to be a very good athlete, struggles.
Yeah, it and, also did give it gave Makhachev a chance to show a little bit of maybe the Islam Makhachev direction he could take his style.
Yeah,
a little more boxing in there.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is that it also showed that Makhachev is, what Phil called more of a clutch fighter than Alex Perez has ever been.
Yes,
because. In some ways, it was a very atypical Alex Perez fight because he lost the first round. Then he had to adjust to the takedowns, and then he started stuffing them with ease and winning the scrambles. And Makhachev started to tire out, and Perez was upping the pressure as the fight went on, which is not what we usually expect out of the sort of front-running bully that Perez usually is. And then round three rolls around, and it's such a strange thing because if you didn't know how to score a round, if you purely were going on vibes, which do matter,
yeah,
Perez wins the round. He's all over Makhachev, whose body language is bad, mm-hmm. who looks tired and timid, and Perez is just marching him down, just crushing his pathetic takedown attempts. But in this process, Perez forgets to throw strikes.
Mm-hmm.
And so he literally loses the round because the only thing offensive that happens at all comes from Makhachev. And we're talking about like five clean strikes.
Yeah.
It's not much, but it's something. And Perez just forgets to do that, and he loses. I think very fairly he loses because you can't score the round on vibes.
Yep.
Not on vibes alone, anyway. Yeah. So what did that say about where Alex Perez is at? First of all, I think ring rust is a factor. He looked quite rusty in the first round. I think also an element of Perez that we've not gotten to delve into as much because we've written him into the front runner category for so long is that he really is maybe just sort of one of these fighters who gets stuck on one idea,
mm-hmm.
who doesn't necessarily have a super clear idea of where he is in a fight if he isn't completely dominating from the start.
Yeah, I mean, I think that would just be kind of one and the same with the front runner part of his personality, which is he comes out with one game and it either works right away or it doesn't work and he doesn't have another plan.
We just saw another aspect of that. He got the game to work, not immediately, but then he kind of like didn't realize what round he was in and what was happening.
Yeah.
He just kind of kept stuffing takedowns. I think it looked very much like he had it in his head, what he had prepared, which is like your win condition is to stop his takedowns.
Mm-hmm.
And he got so fixated on that and was so successful with it that he just forgot to win the round. I think he very easily could have won that third round.
Sure.
Again, he just needed to throw like more than five strikes.
Yep.
Just sell the otherwise overwhelming impression of dominance that you're creating here. But on the other hand, yeah, like he didn't look bad. He looked a little lost. He looked a little like he wasn't entirely sure how to win, but
he's always been a great physical fighter.
And his wrestling.
He knows how to not lose when he's not getting knocked out.
Yeah.
You know, he knows how to scramble, knows how to fight back to his feet. He knows how to pressure. Mm-hmm. If you're not actually just beating Perez badly, he's going to make the fight challenging. He's going to stay in it.
Mm-hmm.
It's just everything is just sort of channeled into one function, you know?
Yeah.
He's a min-maxing.
Yeah.
You know, tank. But like, rather than the you know, in your D&D party, I know how to deploy this person just perfectly for the situation.
Mm-hmm.
He's a min-maxing tank, like early level boss that you battle, where if you're a little underpowered and you didn't really expect that encounter, you're going to lose to him a few times because he does a couple of things and it's just like, oh man, that just took like half my life, that one hit. But then, you know, when you've been playing the game a minute, you just say, oh yeah, no, you just, all you have to do is hit him on the nose when it glows and then like, that's it, it's done.
Yeah. He would beat Leroy Jenkins.
Yes.
Is that I wonder how young our audience is now. That old internet reference will mean nothing to them. So, yeah. And the reason this looks like a fun matchup is that Perez brings that sort of one idea at a time or one idea the whole time pressuring style against most people. And Matthews Nicolau is a much sharper, much more intuitive and flexible counterpuncher whose main problem, really, which was exposed, we're already aware of it, but was certainly the point was driven home by Brandon Royval, who Nicolau decided, I'm going to let this guy walk forward and throw whatever he wants and figure out how to counter it.
Yep.
A problem which also Devin Haney confronted last weekend, if there are any boxing fans out there. I'm going to stand in front of this guy and try to guess what he's going to do.
Yeah.
And that's a bad idea against a guy who has even any idea of how to set anything up and throws a lot of powerful strikes.
Yep. So it could that could make it a problem against Perez.
Sure.
He does know how to come forward a lot and throw some powerful strikes.
Yeah, but his striking is very unimaginative.
Very unimaginative. And when he is coming forward, he's usually when he's throwing more than just a low kick, I would say, he is pushing for he is pushing for the clinch. He's falling out over his front feet, trying to over-pursue and push his opponent into the cage. And he gets just defensively wide open doing it, which is why several fighters have just gone out and countered him with a bomb early and knocked him clean out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's one of the big ways that Alex Perez loses is just having somebody pull a trigger on him and him being totally out of position.
Yep. So I'm going to take Nicolau.
Yeah, me too. I pretty much feel all the same about it. It's just, you know, Perez is, he can make this tough if he can eat or avoid the first stage of Nicolau's offense and then get him to get in on his hips and just turn this into an absolute grind on Nicolau and start slowing him down and wearing him down. But every time he's going to be looking to do that, he's just going to be in position to eat big shots. And he's not so controlled and such a trustworthy finisher that I trust him to just get on Nicolau and stay on him.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, with Nicolau, everyone that's beaten him has kind of just has been able to surprise him with a shot with a strike standing that he didn't expect and knock him out that way. It's never because they were able to just like outgrind him. You know?
Yep.
So yeah, I gotta go with you and pick Nicolau as well. Odds on the bout. Opened at -160. Nicolau opened at -166. Is currently at -181. Perez opened at +148. Is currently at +161. All right. That brings us to a light heavyweight fight. Ryan Spahn versus Anthony Smith 3.
Oh, yeah. These guys have fought before.
That's right. But yeah, Ryan Spahn, Bogdan Gushkov, and you do have to wonder if Spahn is going to go out there and just be like, suddenly have that feeling like, wait, this guy's beat me twice already.
Yeah, he's going to have a panic attack.
Yeah. Maybe he's one of those fighters who just don't pay any attention to their opponent at all in camp and fight. I have no idea who Bogdan Gushkov is or what he looks like.
We're going to see him on the scale just looking completely shook. Oh, God, not again.
Hyperventilating.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, that being said, he did pretty okay in his last fight with Anthony Smith. Maybe he's finally ready to beat him.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a fight that Ryan Spahn should win. He's fast enough. He's powerful enough. He knows how to come forward on people and to shoot, how to shoot and wrestle people to the ground. And he's huge.
Mm-hmm.
It should just work for him. But my God, all he has to do is get in that. Ryan Spahn, I mean, he is such a perfect light heavyweight because he's massive and clearly athletic and has just never learned a goddamn thing.
Yep.
Like, nothing marks the light heavyweight division better than just huge, huge guys that can't learn.
Yep. Well, I was sorely tempted to use a word there that we're not allowed to use. Yeah. Huge. Let me say this. Huge morons.
Huge morons.
We'll say that instead.
Yes. Remedial MMA.
Yeah. I think, in fact, I think the more sort of publicly friendly terms, more current terms you use, the more offensive this joke becomes. Yeah, I would, like, if I call Ryan Spahn learning disabled. Yeah, you know what I mean? That suddenly becomes much more offensive than just calling him an idiot. But yeah,
a lot of glitter and glue sticks in these camps is what I'm saying.
So, Ryan, what'd you work on this training camp? Construction paper? A lot of construction paper? Don't worry, it's okay. The scissors aren't sharp.
Pull out a pipe cleaner, owl.
Ryan Spahn spent the last training camp finally getting the hand turkey down.
That's right. That's right.
Yeah, huge guys who can't learn is really... Everything from middleweight up, really, is sort of defined by that archetype. I don't know what it is. I mean, this is also true in the bigger divisions in, like, boxing. Like,
yeah,
it's just guys who just never change.
Well, I mean, middleweight, to be fair, as you're moving up, middleweight is guys who learned one thing, you know? Usually they can, like, oh, this person, it's like somebody like Israel Adesanya. This guy, he learned how to kickbox.
Yeah.
Maybe nothing else, but he learned how to kickbox at some point.
Yeah. But they never learn anything new is my point.
No, they never learn anything new. They learned one thing.
Yeah.
Middle or light heavyweights, they learned diet and conditioning.
Yeah.
And heavyweights just learned nothing ever at all.
Yeah.
They just walk into the gym one day at 6'5".
Don't have to learn diet. What do you mean?
Yeah. 300 pounds, 6'5". And they have a coach just makes them fast. They show up once every 3 months so they can be locked in a room and made to fast until they get down to 265.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get to go fight.
Yeah.
That is
the coach's job is to pull the cud out of their mouths.
Yes.
Yeah. That's enough. The
heavyweight training camp is just a corral.
Yeah. remove the foie gras corn slurry funnel that they have permanently attached. They have the corn slurry they feed geese to make foie gras. They have that in one of those like beer hats. The double straws leading directly to the gullet. I don't know what it is though. Why is that such a thing? Is it simply because there's fewer guys that size? The gyms they go to, they can just already be good without having to learn. Is it as simple as that?
I think that's part of it. Also, probably, and if you are that big and you're smart, you go into a sport that pays well.
That's certainly part of it too. Yeah.
You know,
why would you go into MMA if you're 6'5"?
Yeah.
So many other things you could do. You could probably have a perfectly, Ryan Spann could have a perfectly profitable career being like the heavy in straight to DVD action movies. Seriously, like just go to Central Casting. You'll get cast as the big intimidating guy.
You haven't seen Hollywood Shuffle, but there are several jokes that I am not allowed to make.
Oh, okay.
About black acting school and like I went to Juilliard and now I get to play, you know, the guy who tries to rape the main character in prison.
Thug number three, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Hey, it happens to white actors too. Keith Jardine doesn't get to play professors. Really funny if somebody did cast him that way.
Anyway, the point is Ryan Spahn has this thing where he gets to the edge of the pocket and he just doesn't know what he wants to do.
Yeah.
He will throw a 1-2 and then shoot behind it sometimes. Other times he'll just freeze up and just walk in and try to hit a takedown or just let his opponent fire away at him.
Mm-hmm.
In part, it's watching his work. In part, it's just indecision. And it's the reason that I picked Anthony Smith to win their rematch is because it's like, you know, Anthony Smith, he can get beat on a lot. And if you don't put him away, he keeps throwing and keeps doing things. And Spahn just, he doesn't deal with that kind of adversity right well.
Mm-hmm.
At all. He has too many moments where he just kind of switches off and checks out.
Mm-hmm.
That said, Bogdan Gushkov is the I bought Roy Jones' training DVDs mm-hmm. and ran them into the ground of mm-hmm. light heavyweight fighters. And Smith should just be able to go out there and hit a takedown, land a 1-2 while Gushkov is out there with his hands down, trying to shimmy and like shoulder roll.
Mm-hmm.
I realize Zach Pauga couldn't do that, but Zach Pauga is a notably less deft puncher than Ryan Spahn.
And notably much smaller. What is Zach Pauga, like 6 feet maybe?
Yeah, maybe. He is 6'2", apparently, but doesn't
look. I don't believe that.
No. Either way, Gushkov he's got a 76-inch reach, and Spahn has an 81-inch reach. And so Spahn can reach Gushkov at a distance where Gushkov can't reach him.
Yep.
And that's enough for me to pick him here. Gushkov, when he gets time to do the things he wants to do on offense, he can be a very dangerous fighter. But he is so used to can crushing that there's just a bunch of his games not developed at all.
Yeah.
So I'll take Spahn, but it's not, you know, he could just literally walk in on Gushkov.
Oh, yeah.
Without anything set and get tagged.
Never underestimate Ryan Spann's ability to freak out and walk into something.
Yeah.
Yeah. Ryan Spahn is one of those fighters who would really, really benefit from In fact, I think this is a thing a great many MMA fighters would benefit from, and I don't get the sense a lot of them do it.
Mm-hmm.
Restricted sparring.
Yeah.
Like, not just not sparring hard, which I also suspect a lot of them don't really do much of. But sparring with, like, you're only allowed to do this.
Yeah.
So you have to think about how your jab only is the obvious example. Uh-huh. You only use your jab. We're going to do 15 rounds. You know, you only lose your jab. And if you get tired, good.
Yeah.
That means you got to relax and just find the positions to stick it out there. It's not about trying to hit the other guy hard. And develop a feel. Like, grapplers do this, and I think MMA fighters do it in grappling training. They call it flow rolling.
Mm-hmm.
You roll for flow. You give up positions. You allow things to get through so that you can just sort of go with the flow and find your way back out of them. This is a very useful exercise in striking, too. I do not get the impression many MMA fighters treat sparring that way.
Yeah.
The way, like, Muay Thai guys spar is like flow sparring.
Uh-huh.
And I certainly don't get the sense Ryan Spann treats it that way, because he is someone who is approaches striking with so much tension and throws absolutely everything as hard as he can. And that is such a terrible approach to boxing or kickboxing, to not have the ability to throw away a shot, to feint, to be relaxed, like you to vary the speed of your combinations. All of that requires you to be relaxed and not full of murderous intent with everything you do.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So yeah, I wouldn't put it past Ryan Spann to get to walk into there's already Roy Jones Jr. I guess this is Roy Jones the 7th style counter.
Mm-hmm.
Roy Jones the what's an insulting, like, kingly epithet for him? Roy Jones the unready.
Yeah.
But Roy Jones the white. But he's so huge and powerful, and Guskov, his style really, really presumes that the opponent is going to be flummoxed.
Yeah.
And even if Ryan Spann is flummoxed, he will throw a huge haymaker, a devastating combination out of fear.
Yeah.
So I'm just totally, and not to mention, as you said, the takedown threat. Spann is an MMA native. He will do a bit of everything if given the chance. And Guskov is not really an initiative seizing fighter. He's going to give Spann the chance.
Yep.
So I will take Ryan Spann too.
Odds on the fight. Spann is the favorite. Opened at minus 185. It's currently minus 189. Guskov opened at plus 144. It's currently at plus 167. All right. That brings us to a women's flyweight bout. Karini Silva, Ariane Lipsky.
This is one of the better fights on the card.
Yeah.
This actually has some significance to it. We've got a couple of developing fighters with title potential.
Uh-huh.
This is better than Spann Guskov. I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah.
I've been so, so impressed. We both have with Ariane Lipsky.
Yeah, absolutely. She's a fighter that, I think we had both written her off around the time that she got ground and pound TKO'd by Antonina Shevchenko.
Yeah.
And has steadily, but as over the, her entire career, honestly, just she has steadily been improving.
Mm-hmm.
And it's never been big improvements. It's never been huge, bold shifts. But it is now at the point where she is good enough that if you do not absolutely decisively take her game away from her, she will just win.
Yep.
There is no two ways about it anymore. There's no like, oh, you might have a hard fight with her like Molly McCann did, or you know, whatever. It's you have to get her down or knock her out.
Yep.
Or she's going to win.
Yep. And she's decidedly harder to get down.
Uh-huh.
And harder to knock out. I mean, I know it's not a great look that within the last couple years, Priscilla Cachoeira managed to KO her.
Yeah.
But, you know, getting caught one big shot. I mean, shit, Dustin Poirier got knocked up by Michael Johnson. Granted, he's better than Priscilla Cachoeira, but that's never a result you would expect to happen even two years after that.
Yeah.
Sometimes it happens. You just get caught by a big punch really early in the fight. Otherwise, for somebody who was an unwilling brawler so often earlier in her career, she has really found her comfort in the cage. Mm-hmm. She looks much, much more relaxed. She is much more insistent on like using good positioning and maintaining the distance to keep herself out of these hectic fights where she loses control. Rather than just like immediately resorting to, I have to scare this person off. They're making me uncomfortable. And as a result, yeah, she's become a much better counterpuncher, has learned to manage her pace a lot better, and she's gotten harder to take down.
Yeah.
She's maintaining the distance better. I think her wrestling has probably improved, but more than that, it's just harder to get to a good shot on her.
Yeah, she's not falling in through her own strikes into the clinch.
Yeah, and hyper-fixating on nailing you in the head with a wild hook that you can just easily time and get under.
Yeah, she's just doing a really good job maintaining her preferred range and distance and making you have to make mistakes to get to her, basically.
Yeah. I think this is probably a tough matchup for Ariane Lipsky. Karine Silva is actually a pretty solid takedown artist and does have some idea of how to use that threat to get some strikes in. I would not call her a good striker, but she does surprise a lot of people.
She's incredibly opportunistic.
Yes.
Really what it is. Like,
yeah.
I don't know if there's any part of her game that I really love, but she is a great opportunistic fighter.
Yeah.
And a really good, she's very, very good at being an aggressive grappler who, yep. You know, she might take risks and make mistakes on the ground that could, you know, and have in the past go really bad for her.
Yeah.
But she will, in the process of doing that, put you in a bad enough spot that you might get submitted instantly.
Yeah. I don't think this is at all an unwinnable fight for Lipsky.
No.
I think it's one of those where she could even perhaps afford to lose a really one-sided round.
Mm-hmm.
And then just make a good adjustment. Like that one-sided round would almost certainly look like her getting taken down.
Yeah.
But if she were able to survive there, that, you know, make a good adjustment, slow things down, enforce a better distance, and suddenly Silva's like one trick stops working.
Mm-hmm.
Could happen. Because, yeah, as you said, like Silva does not have a particularly deep way of setting up her aggressive ground game.
Mm-mm.
She can hit a nice shot. Like at least the timing is good.
Mm-hmm.
But she will also frequently just try to charge into the clinch and take people down from there. And her striking is more or less limited to like low kicks. And yeah, like level change overhand type switch ups.
Yeah.
I think that, again, that's often, it's really easy to underrate the difficulty that that kind of double threat poses to strikers like Ariane Lipsky.
It is.
It's really easy to just look at Lipsky's striking and be like, okay, well, as long as she stops the takedowns, I can expect her to do all of this. And that is so often not what happens. That in the process of stopping the takedowns, it requires so much focus that really like a couple essential gears are removed from the striking engine. and the game just doesn't function the same way anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I think I'm going to conservatively pick Karina Silva here with the hopes that Lipsky is able to stop takedowns and able to keep her striking flow going while stopping those takedowns. But that is that's kind of where I expect it to fail.
I'm going to take the risk on Lipsky, mostly just because I really feel, and I know it's a product of the division too, and the fact that there just aren't a lot of knockout artists that Karina Silva has to be afraid of.
Mm-hmm.
But like, it is one of those games that I just watch it and I'm like, this is going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you are, so much of what you are doing is physicality and vibes. It's just like getting out there, you know, it's like almost a, who was that? Ginger meme fighter in the featherweight division. Spike Carlisle.
Oh, yes.
You know?
The vile Spike Carlisle.
It's like, there's some just like, yeah, you're just going out there and you're just trying to like bully and vibe your way through a fight.
Mm-hmm.
And then she just, you know, insta taps Marina Moroz in her last bout. And Lipsky is 100% capable of being that kind of victim. So I can't overlook it. I can't say, oh, it's not going to happen to her. Although it is worth noting, shockingly, never lost by submission,
mm-hmm.
Marina Moroz.
That's what I mean. This is a fight where she could give up a bad round, and as long as she could compose herself and make probably just the one correct adjustment, very easily get herself back into the fight to a place where she can just stop the takedown from happening again.
Yeah. I'm gonna pick Lipsky on the off chance she can do it, mostly because I feel like she's the kind of fighter that I could see her in like 3 or 4 or 5 years even,
mm-hmm.
being a title contender and like a really good title contender.
Mm-hmm.
Where, you know, maybe we didn't realize it, but she's been actually young veteraning herself through mm-hmm. her career. And at the end, she will just be finally a very good fighter.
I mean, she is 30 now.
Yeah. So I'm saying probably like,
right now she's in smack in the middle of her prime.
Yeah. But I could see at the very end of her prime, her being like,
yeah,
oh, I've got it all figured out finally. And that Jorge Masvidal, here's my shining moment right before it all falls apart kind of way.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. We have both really enjoyed watching Lipsky develop and improve.
And it was great to see her just go out there and like absolutely shit kick Casey O'Neill.
Yeah, it was a huge win.
That was great.
I think did we both pick against her for that one?
We might have.
I have a strange feeling that I might have picked Lipsky, but I can't really.
I know the feeling was generally very much like, this is actually a really bad fight for Casey O'Neill.
Yeah.
And we're picking her based on the idea that she can probably find some way to the mat and win it, but she doesn't try to wrestle near enough.
Yeah.
And if she doesn't do that here, she's just going to lose. So I think we may have hedged for the popular pick, but yeah. I'm going to take Lipsky here for the hell of it, just because I feel like at some point Karina Silva's game is just going to suddenly look really bad.
Mm-hmm.
Because there are so many parts missing from it. Silva opened up at plus 117. It's currently minus 147. Lipsky opened at minus 149. It's currently at plus 132. Yeah, I think Lipsky should be the underdog. Silva, as you noted, she does get in well on takedowns. She can mix up what she's doing with her attacks pretty well. It's just, nothing is clean. Nothing mm-hmm. is actually well put together. All high risk, high reward stuff from her.
Mm-hmm.
All right, that brings us to a heavyweight bout. Jonata Diniz against Austin Lane.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, he's just some swanging and banging big boy heavyweights.
Mm-hmm.
I really pretty much just have to take Dini's here.
Mm-hmm.
After Lane's fight against Justin Taffa.
Lane is just not good.
He is not good at all. I thought he might. He's huge. So I thought he might be able to give Taffa some trouble. Just with all of his wild kicks and movement. He's clearly very fast, too, as a former NFL player. But he is absolutely the stereotype of athlete who turned to fighting so late that they just can't pick up the fundamentals of the game.
Mm-hmm.
And he just doesn't, especially like any fighting that happens in close, he can't do it.
No.
He doesn't know how to wrestle. He doesn't know how to get off his back. He doesn't know how to defend himself in tight. He doesn't know how to throw strikes in tight at all. Like, he is just at the mercy of his opponent when a fight gets into close range.
Mm-hmm.
And Diniz is a big boy who has done a bunch of kickboxing. And even if he wasn't that great a kickboxer, he at the very least knows how to go in and get after people in a hurry.
Mm-hmm.
And
well, he was a kickboxer, was he?
Well, he's got like 20 kickboxing bouts in his record.
Mm-hmm. Doesn't really come through.
No.
His MMA fighting, does it?
He competed for Glory a bunch.
Hey.
So he was fighting at a pretty high level in kickboxing. But
well, I haven't seen his kickboxing bouts. Maybe that's just indication that the skills don't always transfer.
Yeah.
Sport to sport, they frequently don't. Or maybe, I mean,
the man fought Rico Verhoeven. He lost, but
I'm sure he did
fight him at one point.
I'm sure he did. And I should watch that. I should just watch that out of curiosity. I'm sure he lost to both of them, right?
Yeah. Any good kickboxers he faced, he lost to. I think is pretty much the metric there.
Yeah.
Let's see, here's his thing. He beat a couple of kickboxers with a Wikipedia page here and there.
Okay, all right.
You know.
Yeah, that's the eyeball test.
Won an ACB kickboxing heavyweight title.
Okay. Doesn't mean anything.
No. Just
much as I loathe Eddie Hearn, like any fight promoter, he did have the go-to response. What has become my go-to response when somebody talks about somebody being a kickboxing world champion?
Yeah.
I think it was in reference to Andrew Tate.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody was like, he's a kickboxing world champion. And Eddie Hearn said, who isn't?
Yeah.
Okay. He kind of nailed it with that one.
Yeah. If you kickboxed at all, even amateur or professionally.
Yeah. You're a world
and
champion.
You did it for like 5 or 6 years. You probably won one world title.
Yeah. Almost none of which mean anything. 99% of which mean nothing.
Yeah, most he pretty much didn't beat any actually good kickboxers. He beat some decent veterans. Probably the best kickboxer it looks like he beat was Igor Zhirkovich.
You made that name up.
I did not. He was a amateur WAKO champ. And a K-1 Rules Le Grand Tourney champion in 2006.
Kickboxing is a fake sport.
It really is.
It's just so full of these tiny rinky-dink promotions. And they're, yeah. It's just fake.
But yes.
I've never seen a single, there's terrible record-keeping in kickboxing.
It is. People talk every now and then. Somebody will come to me or like, you know, hit me up on Twitter and be like, do you, I really like kickboxing. I want to get into it more. How? And I was just like, if you figure it out, tell me. Cause
yeah.
It is the people that are hardcore kickboxing fans out there.
Yeah.
They are like strange, you know, raving hermits out in the desert who have impossible knowledge that nobody else can attain and spend their entire life.
I'm so sorry, my friend, but
if like suspended 20 feet in the air.
Yeah, you're gonna have to talk to the famous ascetic Luca Bourdon.
Yes,
if you want to know about kickboxing, and if you want to know about Muay Thai, you can talk to my buddy Ryan Wagner,
who
is at best a dangerous lunatic.
And they will both tell you outright, like, oh, yeah. No, this guy is one of the best kickboxers in the world. He only fights Tuesday mornings at 4 a.m. in smoker fights that you can watch on an illegal, like, virus site that is made to give you viruses but also hosts kickboxing streams. Not even streaming and not, like, hidden. It's just, like, called virus.com.
Malware.net.
Yeah, malware.net. they host a Dutch like basement kickboxing shows featuring the five best kickboxers in the world.
Yeah.
Who never fight each other or fight each other 20 times a year. Those are your two options.
Yeah. If fight analysts are like philosophers and you and I are like, I don't know, like whoever writes like pop philosophy books.
Yeah. I'm the Chuck Tingle of MMA.
That's right. These guys are like Diogenes style. Like,
yeah,
you probably shouldn't. They can't be. They're not safe to be around.
No. They will trick you into poisoning yourself.
as a gag.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I like both those guys a lot, of course, but anyway, kickboxing is fake. It's very difficult to follow. Glory, K1, the two Thai stadiums, that's pretty much the only place I know of that where there's like reputable kickboxing with like good fighters and well-kept records.
Yeah. So anyway, Dini's, he's done a bunch of kickboxing. He jumped over into MMA, has only fought cans until he got on the Contender Series and knocked a dude out. Really only knows how to go out there and brawl. That's probably enough to beat Austin Lane.
Yep. Yeah, Denise is, he's tough, you know, like, he's not big like Lane. Lane is big in like a Travis Brown kind of way.
Yeah.
Junata Deniz is big and like he looks like the 5-pound tube of ground beef you get at the grocery store kind of way.
Yeah.
But he is like he certainly seems to be as thick and solid as a fighter as he looks. Mm-hmm. He can take a hard shot. He can take a hard shot well enough that he will counter you as you're hitting him. Like you see that a lot. Lane is probably going to freak out and hit him with some stuff, but it's just if it just doesn't have an effect, Deniz is still going to be there when Lane is exhausted. Two and a half minutes.
To land one really good snapping front kick to the chin, and if that knocks Deniz out cold, then great, Lane won. And if it doesn't, he will fall over and get pounded out.
Yep. Yeah.
That's pretty much it.
That's the fight.
Deniz is the favorite, opened at -239, is currently -247. Lane opened at +208, is currently +214. All right. That brings us to a featherweight bout. Jonathan Pierce, David Onama, and once again, I hope Jonathan Pierce doesn't win this.
Yep.
That's pretty much my pick every time Jonathan Pierce fights. And it's nothing to do with his personality or relentlessly calling Joe Anderson Brito boy.
It's a little bit to do with that.
It's a little bit to do with that.
For me, anyway.
But it's not really to do with that. I don't care or know about Jonathan Pierce's personality. I'm sure he's a fine person.
Yeah, like most MMA fighters.
Yeah. He's whatever.
Look, my assumption is he's probably not a fine person.
My point is, if I have to start liking or disliking fighters based on their personalities, I'm just going to write all of them off.
Yeah. All I'm saying is it doesn't help.
His personality is no different than any other fighter that I can see. But my God, is he just a fun suck blanket.
Yeah.
Just... like, I've been doing a lot of scouting again lately. And I have noticed really heavily that when I see fighters like him, even if I realize that they could probably get to and succeed at a pretty high level in this sport, I pretty much just automatically write them off as being prospects.
Just out of spite. Like, this is not a prospect.
I'm just like, I'm not scouting these dudes. I don't care.
Yeah.
I hate it. I don't want to see it. I'm not interested in it. And it also tends to fail spectacularly at the highest levels. Like it is a skill, a style that can these days can get you all the way up into the middle ranks of the UFC, not like rankings, but into the middle of the UFC division. And then you just tend to run into people over and over again who can shut down your control and hurt you a lot.
Yeah. We've seen this with Grant. What's his name? Grant Dawson.
And Jonathan Pierce against Joannes and Brito, you know, holding them down for like a round and a half. And then Brito gets up once and it's just like, I am going to hurt you so bad that you can't keep fighting.
Yeah. Yeah. Phil and I were talking about this week, but that fight is so funny in on so many levels. Like, I think my favorite thing about it has become that the sequence which begins the get up and do something about it boy, followed by that said boy getting up and doing something about it. The sequence that precedes that is Joanderson Brito mocking Jonathan Pierce for being mad that he is cheating.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's my favorite thing about it. Phil and I were saying more fighters should do this. They should be like, the guy gets, they kick their opponent in the nuts. The opponent's like, and they go, oh, my dick.
Yeah.
Like, it seems so likely to make the average MMA fighter inconsolably angry and to just lose their shit and start fighting terribly. Like, I love that the sequence begins with Brito being, bah, 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 making fun of Jonathan Pierce for correctly pointing out to the referee that Brito's hands are deep inside his glove.
Yep.
It's like, shut up, pussy, crybaby, you tattletale. And then he beats Jonathan Pierce. It's like such an unjust outcome.
It really is.
The bad guy totally wins in that fight. But Jonathan Pierce, if he's the good guy, you just don't want him. It's like a Superman shows up to save you and you'd rather just die. Like, I don't want, this is not the hero I asked for.
Yeah.
Yeah, he is just watching his fights is like watching a Bo Nickel post-fight interview.
Yeah.
It is the exact opposite of entertainment and charisma and personality. And he is totally, totally reliant on taking the fight out of the fight, because if he can't, he tends to get smoked.
Oh, yeah. The not only is the speed not in his game at all, but he does not have any sense of where he is in space as a striker.
Yeah.
Like, he just can't, he cannot see where he is in the cage at all in terms of what, when punches might be coming at him.
Yeah.
Or whatever else. And he, you know, he'll throw out some kicks and he'll kind of robot walk his way into clinch range with some strikes, but all the while he is just right there to get hurt.
Yeah. He's very fortunate he fought Christian Rodriguez up a division and on short notice.
Yeah.
I think if it was the Christian Rodriguez who fought Isaac Dolgarian.
Yeah.
Last time, he probably would have ended up losing.
That makes this fight with David Onama, though, really hard to call.
It does. Yeah. I mean, I think the common factor behind both of Pierce's UFC losses, one of which was in the very last fight of Joe Lauzon's career.
Mm-hmm.
After a 3-fight losing streak, that and Joe Anderson Brito, is that these guys are potent finishers. And really none of his other opponents all of whom he's beaten are. Darren Elkins, Makwan Amirkani, even Christian Rodriguez, Omar Morales, Kai Kamaka III is maybe the hardest puncher in there, but that guy's game just kind of fell apart.
Yep.
None of these guys are like reliably potent fighters.
Nope.
And both Brito and Lauzon are, and they both finished Pierce.
Mm-hmm.
And David Onama is incredibly susceptible to takedowns.
Yeah. He's never seen a position he likes to keep.
No. But he is a good scrambler. He is a brawler, basically, in every single position he finds himself in. And he is a finisher.
He is.
He finishes everyone he fights, except for, he got taken down 8 times by Mason Jones. But
he's never – David Onama has never won a fight by decision.
Yeah.
But it is worth noting, he got taken down 8 times by Mason Jones.
Yeah, and he has gotten finishes in round 2 and round 3 as well.
Yeah.
So, I mean, he gasses for sure.
Yeah.
He does everything way too hard, but he's still dangerous throughout a fight. Mason Jones took him down 8 times, but Mason Jones also went to war with him and had to eat a ton of huge shots. It was a very entertaining back and forth fight. Is Jonathan Pierce capable of winning a fight that looks like that? I say no. I think Onama, even though everything about the style matchup says Onama is just going to get ragdolled by Pierce, provided he can just periodically return to his feet, I think he just remains dangerous enough that I kind of assume Pierce will get hurt at some point or choked out like he did against Brito. He's too like one thought at a time. Like he's too devoted to just any amount of space. Oops, reshoot. Like the dude, I'm surprised there aren't more front headlock chokes on his record. But yeah, I think it's a fight where I just don't know that Pierce is actually a solid enough top control fighter to stop the fight from happening against a guy who is as relentlessly crazy as David Onama.
Yeah, it could be. I don't know. It's so hard because Onama really is such a loose cannon.
Oh, yeah.
You know? It's one of those things, too, where, this is a dude who got relentlessly out-wrestled by Garrett Armfield.
Yep.
For a round before he just remembered, oh wait, this guy's 5'6", a 5'6" bantamweight. I should just probably beat him instead of losing.
Uh-huh.
And went and started hulking him around and winning. And that could easily happen to he could be the same thing where he goes out there and starts losing to Jonathan Pierce and is just oh yeah, wait, I can just win this fight. Or it could just be that Pierce is also he's a 6-foot featherweight and
mm-hmm. Oh, he's gonna lose long portions of it, Onama, no question.
Yeah.
Even picking him, I don't think.
I think I'm gonna pick Pierce as much as I hate to, and I'm just gonna be really actively rooting against my own pick.
Mm-hmm.
Onama makes so many mistakes and it's every one of his wins even tends to feel like it's just been plucked from him losing.
And they all feel like accidents.
Yes. And say what you will about Jonathan Pierce, but him winning never feels like an accident.
No.
He has always set himself on the exact path he needs to win.
Yeah, but Anama's wins don't just feel like accidents. His car, his fights all look like car accidents.
Yes.
Like, that's the thing.
Yeah.
You have to, I don't know, like, pretty good wrestlers and grapplers have failed to contain him for the entirety of a fight.
Yeah.
Which is coupled with the fact that some pretty mediocre wrestlers and grapplers have still gotten him down a ton.
Yeah, and beat him.
Yeah.
Like, Mason Jones is not a... No. Any kind of wrestling specialist, you know? Yeah, I'm gonna pick Pierce, but it is, you know, I think his single-mindedness will actually really work against Onama, who is apt to just give away so many opportunities mm-hmm. for somebody single-minded to just control him.
Yeah.
But it might just only take a minute of Pierce not being able to get right back in on a takedown immediately for him to just get knocked out or tapped out.
Yep.
Pierce is the favorite here, opened at minus 161. It's currently at minus 158. Onama opened at plus 144. It's currently at plus 142. All right. That brings us to the final fight of the main card. Tim Means, Uros Medic, and yeah, this is a good booking, honestly.
You think so? I feel like it's cruel to Tim Means.
Well, I mean, it's hard to tell with Tim Means. I mean, it should be cruel to him, but he's still in a situation where he's not actually getting knocked out.
Well, fight. Not all the time. I mean,
he got knocked out in 2019, and that's the only time he's been knocked out ever.
Yeah.
That's it.
It's also the who did he get? He got dropped like
he got stunned like four times. Kevin Holland and Alex Morono, I think.
Yeah, yeah. Those are two, and then he got hurt so many times against Fialu.
Yeah.
He may not be getting knocked out, but he is getting hurt to the point of being finished.
He is getting hurt a lot.
He just looks much slower and less capable of keeping up with his opponents defensively, which, as we sort of knew and saw coming the entire time, would ultimately be the way that Tim Means' career had to end, because he is a guy who is very, like, he needs his defense to be working.
Yeah, I mean, he's a pocket counter puncher who draws out counters by throwing in volume and then slipping and returning the shots that come back at him.
Yeah, and an aggressive counter puncher.
Yes, an aggressive counter puncher. So he's always going to be putting himself in the pocket for long exchanges that require him to be really mindful all the way through them. And all over his whole career, he's gotten caught a lot for it, you know. Yeah. He's never been a fighter that does not get hit in fights.
Yeah,
I mean, I guess the point I was just saying is that it's interesting because Medic's game is so single dimensional.
Yes.
You know, he really has to be getting you standing. He's not going to be, he does not have a functional ground game, really. And he's not actually a great pocket fighter either. He's good at really long range or really close range. So there is some room for Means to just go out and, like, Semmelsberger just kind of marched Medic down and hurt him really quickly in their fight in the middle distance. It's just that afterward, his corner kept telling him to clinch up, or he kept trying to clinch up and just got owned in the clinch by Medic. I'm going to take Uros Medic here just because, as you noted, Means is getting hurt a lot more. But there are places that Tim Means could win this fight, even 40-year-old Tim Means, if he just doesn't get knocked out and he can just make the fight hard.
Yeah.
Because I don't think Medic is going to submit him. And then otherwise, you know, you've got The only other losses that other than submissions that Tim Means has had in recent years are all narrow split decisions.
Yeah, Tim Means has had split decisions all throughout his career.
Yeah, I'm just saying, like, if you don't get him out of there, he still tends to make a lot of good reads and be very tough to beat.
For sure.
Over the length of a fight.
Yeah, I think the thing was in that fight with Fialho, to me, that coming off of three straight losses,
yeah,
that felt like a perfect retirement fight.
It did. It did.
By which I mean, it was a win. It was a hard fought win. And it also, it was hard fought in such a way that made me think, I don't think I want to see Tim Means fight anymore.
Yeah.
Because he is in here against a guy who, when he is in these moments of technical brilliance, when he's showing his class, he is outclassing Fialho.
Yeah.
And yet he cannot stop getting hurt.
Yeah.
He cannot stop getting into long sequences of, like, having a notably timid fighter drive him to the cage and then him just, like, sort of trying to time really obvious power punches and not being able to do it.
Yeah.
The reaction time didn't look like it was there. That's a bad sign for a guy like Tim Means, who is always going to be in danger of getting hit clean at any range. So yeah, I mean, that's really the main reason I'm picking here. I mean, I agree. I don't think Medich would be the by any means one of the better guys Means has ever beaten.
Indeed,
but I just don't think Means has it anymore.
Yeah, it's. I mean, yeah, you're not. I'm not picking Means either. I still want to believe.
Oh, we both love Tim Means. I mean,
yeah. And Medich is when he gets his chance, and he'll probably get a lot of good chances with Means as Means tries to establish range. When Medich is out at distance, he is a scary, dangerous fighter.
Yeah.
He's got some real, like, Michael Venom Page to him from way outside.
Mm-hmm.
So all right. Yeah, I'm picking against Means as well. I guess I had to hear somebody else say it to really solidify it in my mind.
Yeah.
Means open at +178. He's currently up at +253. Medich opened at -233. He's currently down at -299. I get it. It's fine. Means, you really should have retired off that Fialho win.
Yeah, I'm not going to hold it against him or anything.
No.
Again, I'm not saying it's impossible that he could win again, but it just felt like a perfect, you know, like, it's just, I don't want to have the feeling that Tim Means was somewhat fortunate to beat Andre Fialho. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's a feeling I want to have but once in a beloved fighter's career.
Yeah, we don't need to watch him. If he wins this to, like, barely squeak out one against Uroš Medich.
Yeah.
And then fighting again, and you're just like, I don't need to see you barely beating guys that, like, you should just be wiping out.
He's had a long, wonderful, middle-of-the-pack action fighter career.
Yep.
He is 40 years old.
Yep.
That's about the limit, I think.
It is insane, honestly, that MMA and the UFC have afforded him as much time in the spotlight as they have.
Yeah.
Like, that is something that MMA really allows for in ways that boxing does not nearly so much. Is for a guy like Tim Means to be on reasonably big cards for 10 years straight without ever even coming close to being a title contender ever.
Yeah. Just a mainstay mid-card fighter.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right.
This makes me feel like whatever happens, I want to write something about Tim Means.
Yeah, we should. You should.
For my Substack. I don't think I've ever written about him. And I just, yeah, when Tim Means was on, man, such an incredibly fun and interesting striker to watch.
Yeah. Like, you know, a real testament to a fighter investing their time in skill mm-hmm. and strategy.
Yeah.
Rather than just, you know, leaning on athletic gifts.
Yep. Yeah, guess why? Welterweight. Welterweight. <Yeah. laughs> If he were one division up, he would have invested all of his time in a slightly, significantly smaller pool of skill.
Yeah.
And one division beyond that, no learning at all. But down at welterweight, that's where you start to find the guys who are craftsmen.
Yep.
Tim Means is definitely a craftsman.
All right.
To access the bonus content of this episode, you must be a paid subscriber. To do that, go to themmadrawpodcast.substack.com and subscribe today.